One definition of music has been humanly organized sound. I was reading a little newspaper put out somewhere, I think in Woodstock, New York, on contemporary music, and they had an interview with Pauline Oliveris, who's a composer in California. She objected to this definition of music being humanly organized sound, and she cited the example of baboons in Africa that, when the sun is rising, begin a little musical event. They all gather together and they start on a special note. They always start on the same note, a concert E. And then as the sun is rising, they go upwards by half steps, a chromatic scale by half steps as the sun is rising, until finally the sun bursts over the horizon and they reach an octave above the E that they started on, an octave above the note that they began on, another E. And an octave, of course, is the simplest musical interval. So at this point, the sun has risen and they reach a sort of musical ecstasy, and they're all jumping around and singing the same E. And Pauline Oliveris says, well, if this isn't music, what is? And I agree with her completely. So that must take the human element out of the definition. We can no longer say humanly organized sound. So perhaps we should say organized sound. By the way, there have been musicians that have used such music as that was produced by these baboons. For example, there are a couple of records in which the musicians play with animals, for instance, whales. There's a famous jazz flutist, Paul Horn, who's done a record with whales. He plays his flute and the whale responds, and he responds to the whale. And this Easter, I played for a sunrise service, well, pre-sunrise service at 5 a.m. at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. And we all gathered outside, and I, first there were quite a few moments of silence, and then I was playing a little tune on my flute, and there was a cardinal up in the tree, and we all seemed fairly certain that the cardinal was responding to me, and then I would sort of respond to the cardinal. I'd pause a little bit when I heard him, and then I'd play a little bit more, and then he'd play back. Well, is music just organized sound? Then we'd have to include things like Morse code, which I suppose could be a kind of music, really, to our hearts if the code conveyed a message that meant a lot to us, a very emotional message, then we would feel as though we were listening to the most beautiful music, perhaps. But in general, I don't know if we could call music, which is certainly organized sound, or rather Morse code, music. And another example is the little bell beeps that we hear when we dial the telephone with the push-button telephone. Bop, beep, bop, 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 beep. I don't know if that is exactly what we call music either. So there's something missing, and it's those inward stirrings that we somehow have to express in the definition. So perhaps we could say that music is organized sound that moves the spirit. Maybe that's a little bit closer. And then this moving of the spirit, in this moving of the spirit part of the definition, we see that perhaps it's going to get a little sticky. It's not going to be as easy to define music and explain exactly what we mean as we might have thought. So these spirit movings that are involved in music, moving of the spirit, is what leads us to the central mystery of music. So all of a sudden there is a sort of a mystery that's involved in music. and the three aspects, performing, composing, and listening. So, on the face of it, well, many people think that they know what those mean, composing, being the most creative, perhaps, of the three, and through which music is born, and then the performing, which we might say is the second most creative aspect of music that involves a lot of technical proficiency and knowledge, and then listening maybe on the bottom of the list, and this is absorbing what the composer has created. Well, but with that, those spirit stirrings in mind that have lurked out from the definition, perhaps that's not so true anymore, at least that composing is more important, more creative than performing and or than listening. So in terms of the previous definition that I suggested, we might say that a composer is a sound organizer whose spirit is moved, or the act of composing is the process of organizing sound in such a way that it expresses these stirrings of the spirit. And obviously, the most important thing is that we have to somehow capture them. We have to somehow touch those places inside that are to be stirred, or activate them, or find those places, somehow be involved with that mystery, whatever it is. And the medium that a composer is involved with, of course, is sound, which also we may take for granted, but in reality it's something very concrete. Sound. It's nothing but the air vibrating from some item that's vibrating, like this chair. I set it in motion, vibrating for an instant, and then that vibration jumps from this wood and passes through the air into our ears. Now a bell vibrates for a longer period of time, or that this. And so it's still vibrating. It vibrates longer. The vibrations aren't deadened like they are in the wood, so it stops after a short period after I hit the wood, whereas that continues. Now, I might, in most musical instruments, I'm setting something like that in motion, like a drum head by striking it, or a cymbal, or perhaps a string by plucking it, as if I were to be playing a guitar, or rubbing against the string with a bow, as in the violin, or a column of air. I blow across a little edge in a flute, which sets the air inside the flute vibrating. Which produces the sound. So actually all of those involve the air being set in motion and vibrating. And there are certain definite physical principles involved in the air's vibrating. For example, this, if I just close all the holes in my flute, I have a tube that's a certain length, a tube that's as long as from here to here. Now, if I blow harder, I can get different notes. I wasn't moving my fingers at all. I'm just blowing a little bit harder each time, and I get many different notes. Now, I played a little tune, and I can't play any notes in between the ones that I played. I can sing it. Oh. bom, 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 then I can't go any higher. But that little tune is always the same for one particular length of the tube. And the way it works is that the first note I played was so many cycles per second. The air is vibrating so many times per second, say 100, as it goes along. And that produces a certain note. Then the second one I played was exactly twice that number of vibrations per second. So if that's 100, then if I blow a little higher, I get that note, and that would be 200 cycles per second. The next one, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 700, and so on, ad infinitum. So there are certain definite principles involved, and due to the physics of sound, this medium that the composer is working with, there are certain relationships that we could say are more simple or more pure in a way. They might perhaps sound more pure to our ear than others. This is simply due to physics, that if I play these two notes together, if I had two flutes and played them together, it would sound very pure, whereas if I played those two together, or these two, it would sound more clashing. And if I had two flutes again, I could demonstrate that quite clearly. But that is simply due to physics, that certain relationships between various sounds affect us in different ways. So, well, other things that the composer works with are how high or low the sound is, the pitch of the sound, and then its rhythm, its pulse. And this goes back to our heartbeat. For example, in a piece of music, although the composer may not make any indications for changing the pulse, the speed of the music changes slightly as the mood of the performer changes slightly. Just as if all of a sudden we become a little bit more excited, even by something that we may hear in a discussion, and we're not actively participating at all, then it's possible that our pulse inside, maybe several of our pulses, our heartbeat pulse and the pulse of our breathing, it's possible that these pulses, as we become a little bit more excited about something, change slightly, become a little bit faster and maybe a little bit slower as we become more relaxed. So also in the same piece of music, the pulse will change. So if we really examine it, the composer is working with principles that are very simple, really. I mean, down in the very skeleton and the very bottom of things, this business of sound, of matter vibrating first at one speed and then exactly twice that speed and exactly three times that speed and so on. So there are certain very simple principles involved in the composer's medium, which of course he hopes to use to express the result of his having touched that mystery inside somehow. So now that I've tried to explain somewhat the medium of music, traveling through the air and the physics of it all, I suppose I could try to explain these stirrings of the spirit, if that's at all possible. Now, there are things that might set them in motion, that might somehow touch inside of us somewhere that begins that motion inside. There are certain catalysts, such as nature. If we look around and see a beautiful sight. It's like music. And it's very similar. And this is what might happen to a composer. He might see a beautiful, peaceful scene that inspires him to compose music in a certain way. For example, in Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, there's a beautiful musical expression or example of a storm. And it really does sound a lot like a storm. Or often composers are very enthralled with bird song. For instance, in that same symphony by Beethoven, there's a beautiful little song of birds and a little cuckoo call and so on. Well, there's a contemporary composer who's also very interested in that, Messiaen, who's studied bird song intensively. Then, of course, there are human emotions that we can describe, like a composer may attempt to describe through the music his feeling of love for someone, or even anger or tension of some kind. Then specific events may play a part in the composer's attempting to, in stirring the composer's artistic strings. For instance, he may write a piece of music to commemorate a victory in a battle, which was done quite often several hundred years ago. Or another way of sort of commemorating an event might be seen in the music of John Cage, which at first was very shocking to many people. He has a piece called, I don't know, 4 minutes and 38 seconds or something. I forget what the exact title is. But the pianist comes out and sits down at the piano, puts the music up, and maybe lifts the thing over the piano, lifts the thing above the keys, whatever that's called, and sits there for 4 minutes and 38 seconds, or however long it is. And that's the end of the piece. So that commemorates that time period. And you hear people getting up to leave, and you hear people rustling in their seats, and you see maybe the sun setting. Well, that's not likely, but unless it were planned at exactly the right time. But I imagine he wouldn't want that, the sun to be setting or something else to be happening during that period. But that's a kind of commemoration of certain events. So that involves all of the aspects of in this definition of music. The organization, it's organized in that Cage has written down these instructions that you sit there for so many minutes. And the stirrings of the spirit as well, because I'm sure he has a picture of what the reaction is going to be, however vague. But more important, he wants everyone to experience whatever stirrings of the spirit may occur at that moment. And a lot of them have to do with people's rehashing over their definition of music. Or any other thing might set in motion a composer's spirit strings. For instance, on Saturday Duane, we and I are going to play a piece called The Wind, and it sounds very much like the wind.
Lemur. Lemur, I say that's a good example, isn't it? The sea.
Oh, yes, yeah, by Debussy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Because you can almost hear the roll of
the sea. Sure.
Yeah,
or in Smetana's The Moldau, he wrote that it's a picture of a river in his native country, and it sounds very much like various streams gushing together and the river going along. And then you hear hunting horns in the distance because you're going along the river. Smetana's on a raft in the river, and he hears a hunt off to one side, the hunting horns, and then over here a peasant wedding. You have peasant wedding music Another thing that composers sometimes use now, contemporary composers, is just a simple formula, a simple dry formula. Many composers may be convinced that they can completely do without these stirrings of the spirit, many contemporary composers. But I am fairly certain that whether they like it or not, that's an integral part of their music and why it works. Because whether they like it or not, their formula somehow plugs into that. Even computer music. If you program a computer in such a way that it didn't have any of this, then it would be uninteresting. But maybe it would be impossible anyway, because of the fact that sound affects us in various ways, and that in itself is a mystery as to how the sounds exactly affect us. So I don't think that one can get away from these stirrings of the spirit, from that part of the definition, however much one tries. And some contemporary composers do seem to be trying somewhat. But I don't believe that was, for instance, Cage's idea when he wrote this piece involving so many minutes of silence. So the music, however, is not a simple translation of these things. In Smetana's Moldau, it's not simply a picture of the river and of the hunt going on and the peasant wedding and so on. These are more just catalysts, again, than they are really the subject matter. In other words, the music has a life of its own aside from these things. So from that, one might deduce that a listener or performer who has absolutely no idea what these catalysts might have been, say you didn't read the script, you had no idea what Smetana had in mind, you had no idea that Debussy had in mind the sea when he wrote the sea, you don't know the title of the piece. Well, these listeners and even performers that don't know this about the music still, for the most part, can receive this essence of mystery that the music carried in the first place. In other words, the peasant wedding by the side of the river set in motion something inside of Smetana, the composer, and that can be transferred to a listener or even a performer, even a conductor who doesn't know this, without, for the most part, without his being knowledgeable of these catalysts.
Would you say with Smetana that the catalyst is the river? Or what are you talking about? Is catalyst?
Yes, but more, well, the river.
Is it built around, or the thing
yes,
that
brings
but, out the
but
other
more
thing?
Important in that work, really, it's a spirit of nationalism in a way, because it ends with the river flowing by a great castle, and which brings peace to all the people of his country, a feeling of nationalistic pride, whereas the people of his country at the time were being their nationalism, their sense of pride in their country was being gnawed away at.
Then nationalism is the catalyst in that.
In a way, yes, and
and use the river for the...
The river and everything that's going on either bank is a symbol of this nationalism in a way, but you could call all of those things sort of the catalysts that set the music in motion. And if we know these things, though, if we realize this, then it's a different kind of catalyst for us, too, and it sets in motion those feelings within us too, but they aren't necessarily directly related to the musical experience. For instance, in certain... Now, I'm not exactly sure how historically correct I am, but in certain battles for independence or something that the Italians had, they would sing excerpts from opera by Verdi, not purely because of the musical stuff that was in the music, but because of what it makes them think of, and because of the fact that they knew that Verdi had the same desires to, you know, of sort of nationalism. So I'd like to try to find a few examples of this, of cases in which someone who knows nothing about these catalysts and about music in general, has had no training about music, can completely absorb this essence of music. For example, if we hear the hunting horn in Smetana's Moldau, we may not realize that it's a hunting horn if we're from some culture that doesn't know anything about hunting horns. But still, just in the sound of a hunting horn, there's some of that call and excitement because of the nature of, one, the instrument that plays the hunting horn that's very bold and, if I may, well, sort of manly and, I don't know, bum ba bee ba 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 da bee. Well, I'm not seeing the right intervals, but the intervals are very pure, are very simple. They are the same intervals that I can play without moving my fingers, the same intervals that a bugle plays. And this is why a bugle is so effective in waking up all the soldiers or calling them to arms or dinner, or in pronouncing the death of someone that was very close to us, a bugle call, because it's using very simple intervals, just one or two or three or four times the same fundamental frequency. In other words, in taps, I'm using, let's see, the third harmonic, which would be three times the fundamental. So if the bottom note was 100 cycles per second, then I'm using 300, 300, 300, 400, 300, 400, 500, 3, 4, 5, 300, 400, 500, and those are exact numbers of cycles per second. So you can see that the relationship between those notes is very simple. And in the sound of a hunting horn, you have the same thing, because it can only produce that notes, those notes, because just like a bugle, it's just one length of tubing, whereas in the modern trumpet, you have valves that open the tubing and make it, all of a sudden, make it have different lengths, whether or not, depending on whether or not you open or close the valves. So with that one length of tubing, you can produce only those notes. And then in the first place, as I said, the hunting horn has a specific sound that just lends itself to the nature of the hunt and calling people, all of a sudden, here's a fox over here. So these things will be absorbed by someone who doesn't realize that it's a hunting horn. Still, you'll have that same feeling, because that's why the hunting horn sounds like that in the first place, or rather why people chose that sound and that particular melody to call people to the hunt or whatever. So the basic things underneath this hunting horn sound will be absorbed by a listener who doesn't realize that it's a hunting horn or that has never heard of one. A friend of mine traveled in India when there was a festival of music, various festivals of music going on throughout the country. He went to many concerts, and he said that often in a concert of Indian music, a sigh would travel through the whole audience. All of a sudden, something would happen on stage, and a sigh would just travel, ripple through the audience because of something that happened in the music that somehow, if we could, but I don't think we ever will be able to, we could explain in terms of the physics of sound. And I'm sure this is something that would affect not only those sitting in the audience, but one of us, if we went there and previously it had no exposure to Indian music. It's just something physically that all of a sudden draws a sigh out of everyone present. In Switzerland, a friend of mine writes critiques for a newspaper on various records. And he had a record that he wanted me to hear of Bulgarian choir music. This choir is made of, well, the singers are all peasant girls from Bulgaria. I assume they don't read music. But the first time that I heard this song, it just drew tears out of me, and it has had that effect on me ever since and on many other people, because it's so incredibly tender. And I found out on the back of the record jacket, sure enough, it's a love song. I knew nothing about Bulgarian music or Bulgaria. And of course, these are people that are even farther distant from us than your normal Bulgarian in a big city. These are peasant girls that were singing together with one mind or one spirit or whatever, this love song that had such a strong effect on me. So this is another example of an uninitiated who draws the majority of the benefit from music, with knowing nothing from it, however. I think, though, that my musical training has, helped me in that respect, though, because I was open to it. I was more receptive to it. And I knew that in, say, Indian music or African music or American Indian music, that there are certain gems that we all can absorb. And then another key, of course, another catalyst that a composer will use to set in motion these stirrings of the spirit and that are a catalyst to the production of the music is the text. Texts of music, say of a song. The question might arise, if you don't understand the text, how much can you really get from the music? Well, Bach sometimes used the same music to a different text. He wrote, I think, three sets of cantatas, I think, for every Sunday in the year. In other words, he wrote a different musical cantata lasting maybe half an hour for each Sunday of the year, but three times. So sometimes maybe when he didn't have enough time for the coming Sunday, he quickly attached a text to one that he had written before, or perhaps he felt that one that he had already written was quite appropriate. The music for a cantata that he had written was appropriate for this text for this coming Sunday. So that shows that the text that music arises from may be given a completely different musical setting or vice versa. Not long ago at University of Northern Iowa, we performed the St. John Passion by Bach, which is a very long work. These were mostly amateurs, and it was a full house. Toward the end, there were a number of people in the orchestra, or rather after the whole thing was over, many people commented that they felt tears running down their cheeks at this point in the music, or near the end. There were at least four people that I know of, in the audience as well as performers, to whom this happened. And I tried to figure out why. I don't think it could have been because everyone was so knowledgeable of the text, because in the first place the performers didn't have the translation in front of them, and it's all in German. So although the audience did have the text in front of them, I'm fairly certain that it was forgotten, or rather they perhaps had just an idea of the text in mind, but they certainly weren't following it as they went. And again, this would have been impossible for the performers who have their flutes or English horns or whatever in their mouths and aren't without a program in front of them giving the translation. So I think that the reason why this performance had this effect, which many professional groups may not be able to produce, say the Berlin Philharmonic with the greatest choir in Berlin, the reason why we were able to bring this about was because of seriousness of intent, primarily coming from two people at first, the first being Bach himself, and this is what makes, what sort of sets Bach apart among composers, makes him a very important composer, this seriousness of intent that I think acts in focusing his mind and allowing him to work with these physical properties of sound that I cited earlier in expressing these things that he feels. Also, it had to do with the seriousness of the conductor, who had studied the work extensively. And of course, primarily, he'd studied the text of the work and how it fits with the music. But I think that his studying of the text was more a shortcut, really, than it was a necessary ingredient. If he had a lot of time at his disposal to work with the musicians and to feel the sounds that came from the music, or if he could visualize them in his mind very clearly without having to have the performers play it back to him, then he might have discovered some of these things that he discovered through examining the text without really doing so, without really knowing the words. I think that the story behind the St. John Passion acted as a catalyst in Bach, in that directed him towards such a wonderful expression of certain feelings. It acted as a catalyst in that it focused his mind, this story, focused Bach's mind in such a way that he produced music that was wonderfully balanced and with a single-mindedness, a certain single-mindedness. Another way of expressing this seriousness might be faithfulness to that mystery, which is usually very difficult to have in an uninterrupted stream. So Bach was capable of doing this more than many other composers because of a certain seriousness that he had. And we were very fortunate in that our conductor was very seriousness. He attempted to explore all aspects of the music and the text to the best of his ability. And although he was working with a completely amateur choral group of 150 voices, all standing behind the orchestra, and although he was working with an orchestra that you might say was definitely second rate, he was able to produce this kind of effect that is generally not produced in among performances of the St. John Passion. Okay, so with regard to this mystery, I believe that the professional musician, be he a performer or a composer or appreciator, a music critic, for example, really understands no more about this mystery than the non-musician. For example, sometimes some of the best comments about a performance can come from someone who knows nothing about music, who's had no musical background. I found this fairly often, that some people who have the most meaningful things to say might be the non-musician. So a musician, a performer, might attempt to increase his skills and practice many, many hours, which will be effective, but only if he, in the process, attempts to become more receptive to this mystery. One musician once said that if you see a dynamic sign on a piece of paper, a crescendo or a forte or a piano or various other signs, they all mean the same thing. They all mean listen, open your ears, and be receptive to what there is on the page, which to me made a lot of sense. So the way I visualize this mystery is as a kind of instrument that's being played inside of us, that we all have with birth, and that is pretty much the same from person to person. It's the same sort of thing, whether we be from one continent or another. But it's a very vast instrument with many, many strings. In one culture, a different set of strings will be set in vibration by their music. And in another, it's another set of strings. So the whole instrument is there. We only need to allow those strings that are vibrating in this Peruvian music, and that were vibrating in the when the composer wrote it, we only need to let those same strings vibrate within us, which may be ones that are usually dormant. But there are many things that keep those strings from being activated, from vibrating. Well, many times they vibrate in spite of us. One example might be a musician who is very jealous of another musician who's on the stage. This other musician is much, we might think, more technically proficient, and we don't want to accept his music because of these feelings that we have. Well, if the musician is carried by the music, by this instrument inside of him, then whether he likes it or not, this jealous musician is going to have some of the same feelings and be carried by it. This doesn't happen all the time, but that just shows that it can be a very powerful experience. And that's why such a powerful experience could have been set in motion from just two people, well, Bach and then the conductor of the St. John Passion. They influenced the whole chorus and then the whole orchestra, which in turn influenced the whole audience in a very natural way. So there are things that make cloud this instrument and keep and muffle it and keep it from vibrating. For instance, expectations that we have. There may be a certain kind of music that we like very much and we expected another kind of music to be like this. Then we, in expecting something else, we won't fully be able to appreciate the other. Or there are many people who go to concerts not to really appreciate what's being played, but rather for the whole social scene, especially people that hold opera season tickets or something. It may be because they sincerely love opera or a particular work, but many times it's just because of the whole social aspect of these performances. Well, to close, I have a couple of pieces by Indian composers. One of them is by a contemporary Indian composer who has written into the music many of the inflections of his native music. And then a little piece of Indian music on the instrument on which it was played, or rather one of the native instruments of India. And then, well, if you have any questions, please ask them. So this is called Song by a fellow named Van Raj Bahatya, and I assume that he lived in London. I really don't know anything about him except that he's from India, but I do know that the music sounds very much, there is a poem that goes along with this song. It's a folk song. Cool water, white moonlit night, a streamlet hidden in the leaves, water I shall drink from your hands alone, fair one. Have the pitcher cleaned. In others' gardens, flowers bloom. In mine grow only bananas. This very night, meet me if you must, for the chance shall not be again. In others' gardens, flowers bloom. In mine grow only cabbages. Bargain is not in my mind, fair one, just greedy, for you are my eyes.
Thank you.
It's nice to have the water fountain in the background, kind of like the well water. I don't exactly understand that poem, to tell the truth, but I think it's kind of a sort of love song with a little hint of humor in there. Well, anyway. Now this is a copy of a South Indian flute, the kind of flute that this man was, I really don't know if he's from South India or North India, because there are two schools of classical music in India, the North and the South, and this is the South Indian variety of flute. The North is much larger and has a much deeper sound, but it's normally made of bamboo. This one is made of material made of pressed paper, and this stuff was used as insulation for some kind of wires. They found that it was very resonant and that it worked quite well for these flutes. For one thing, it doesn't crack the way bamboo does. The problem that they've had with Indian flutes is that, of course, they do crack, and the fellow that I studied the Indian flute from, T. Vishwanathan, had a flute maker back in India who made all of his flutes, but he was becoming a very, very old man and wasn't able to make the flutes anymore, and unfortunately he wouldn't fork out his secrets. Now, I think everybody knew a couple of them, that, for instance, that they buried the bamboo in the mud by the riverbank for a couple of months and they smoked it for a certain length of time, but there were certain other secrets that he just didn't give out. So finally, this teacher of mine of this kind of flute had his bamboo flute copied by someone in California in this pressed paper material. So I'll play just a little song that I learned. My repertoire is not very large on this instrument, but I'll play one song that I learned, a South Indian song. All of the flute music is vocal music. They just play the songs on the one instrument, the flute, and there's very elaborate ornamentation involved. In fact, the song itself is very simple. It just goes, la 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 li la li 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 la 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 li la 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 la. Well, but then this is ornamented in a special way. I wish I could tell you the text of the song or who wrote it. I think it was written in the 18th century, a couple hundred years ago. Musical sort of trinity are somewhat incomplete, But, well, I did the best I can, and if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to attempt to answer them. But first, I just thought of one more little way in which it relates to the Trinity as we know it. We could say that the Father would be composing, the originating, and not that this relates exactly, but that this is another way of looking at the relationship of composing, performing, and listening, and how they go back to a central idea or mysterious thing inside of us. The composing would be the sort of Father image, and then the Son is obviously performing, because that uses the medium, and in the relationship between the Father and the Son, it is a sort of a translating of this into terms that we understand, Jesus Christ, in other words. So, well, this sounds absurd now to be making this, but performing would be that, in which we're using the medium that we understand and that we have, the material that we use to make these sounds, and the human material of our, well, but that's involved in all three, the emotions and so on, and the catalysts. But so then, the Holy Ghost, of course, is the only one left, listening, the transference of these ideas, or these stirrings of the Spirit. The transference, the process of its being also absorbed by us. So, take that one or leave it. Any questions?
That's kind of an interesting analogy. And
yeah.
I like the way you leave it there. And we interpret differently.
We,
the listener, mm-hmm. interprets differently.
Differently. From,
I mean, each one of us
oh, yes.
may interpret uh-huh. a little differently as it relates to our particular life and experiences.
Yes.
As we do, I think, with God
uh-huh.
and Christ.
And the Trinity,
yes.
as we have different uh-huh. conceptions of that. Yeah, but we all have a different idea. We all perceive it differently. But there's something there that we have in common, no matter where we grew up, or I mean, and that's what we're trying to find out. That is sort of this massive substance we have in common with everyone, and that's what we're trying to find out about, or maybe not. I don't have to say just that it's inside of us, but something that's such a mystery that we're trying to grope for, and that mystery is in a way the same, but it's our perception of it, perhaps. Well,
I think everyone has their own innate response. We were born with this ability to respond.
Mm-hmm.
Our experience and things change this innate possibility.
Uh-huh. Yeah, don't you think it's as though we have many, many possibilities, mm-hmm. like that instrument, that mysterious mm-hmm. instrument inside of us, and we may play these strings if we're from this culture, or grow up in a certain way, and we may play these others, but if we've never been exposed to these, and someone plays them and we're in a receptive mood, then they'll ring inside of us too.